So in my email introduction, I mentioned that someone had lent me the CD series from Brené Brown's The Power of Vulnerability. And as David laid the phone down that records this, I remember the first time I was here and that phone was laid down, and that was a vulnerable moment for me. Because to be recorded can bring up, especially anybody who's a perfectionist, you know, all the imperfections that in this talk are recorded. Fortunately, I'm in recovery. And so I've gotten pretty much over that. And yet the perfectionist in me I take so many notes, but it's all right. So I found Brené Brown really interesting the first time I saw her TED talk on vulnerability. I sent it to so many people because it just blew me away. And I can't even tell you why, except that, because that was years ago, except that she is such a wonderful speaker because she is so vulnerable herself. She speaks from her own life, and she talks about the research that she does as a social worker. It's called grounded theory, which I never had heard of before. But you draw conclusions based on interviews from thousands of people. And, you know, based on that, you can see patterns and you can kind of begin to categorize things and make conclusions. And this research that she found really rocked her world. I believe she said she took a year off from her work to really examine her own life. And she went to a therapist. She created a syllabus. And she took it to a therapist and said, "These are the things I want to work on, and I want to work on them in this order.
Wow.
I thought that was interesting. But the thing that rocked her world was there was a group of people that she calls those that live wholeheartedly, and it's about 20% of the population. And I'm not really clear about the details of her research, if it's just people in the U.S., probably. But what she found is there's 10 practices in the way that they live that really allowed them to have what she calls wholehearted lives, really living fully. And so that's what was on the 6 CD series. And so that was way more material. So I cut out as much. I mean, I tried to bring to you what I thought was really interesting points. You'll just have to find the series or read the book yourself. But she talks about living these practices, these guideposts, as if you're following a northern star. And of course, when you follow that star, you're not going to reach that star, but it keeps you moving in the right direction. And these ways of these practices, she calls them subversive compared to social norms. Because when you're allowing yourself to be vulnerable, you're allowing yourself to, you're revealing who you are. And most people don't really do that. I mean, it's sort of scary to do, for one thing. And to be vulnerable is, there's so much risk involved in being rejected or criticized or, you know, all of that comes up. And so most people, or a lot of people, don't even go there. So, but the risk of not living from vulnerability is that you don't get to live the life that you're meant to live. So to me, that's a much greater risk. That one of my greatest fears is that I won't reach my full potential. So I am getting a lot better at taking risks and stepping out there and being who I am And fortunately, finding a community that accepts me, knowing that mainstream society is not going to probably resonate with most of who I am. And I've come to say, you know, that's okay. That's okay. So, speaking of society, Brené Brown says that, you know, we live in a scarcity society that where there's not enough of anything. And that also reflects in not enough, that we feel like we're not enough. And so there's all that worthiness that keeps us from really feeling good about who we are. And there's a lot of value judgments. And she suggests that we really, as a society, should shift, like when you meet somebody new, instead of saying, well, what do you do? Because there's a lot of value, ranking, importance in that question. And instead ask, what do you love? And I thought, wow, boy, will that reveal more about who the person is than what they do? So a lot of her research is around shame. And when she tells people she's she's a shame researcher, everybody just, nobody wants to really go into that, what that means. They just, oh, that's interesting, and go on to something else. Because who wants to talk about, you know, shame or what shames us or the feeling of shame? You know, that's like what we want to hide. That's the shadow stuff. But a lot of the shame that we experience, we feel as that we're not enough. And when we're shamed as children, it affects the very essence of who we are. It's the self piece. It's not the way that most parents shame. They're not creating guilt about the behavior, which can change behavior. They're saying, you're not good. It's not, you know, maybe today it's very different, and parents are very, very much more evolved in the way that they talk to children. But I think in a lot of people in the generation that I grew up in, there wasn't that kind of awareness. And so when you're shamed as a child and you have this feeling of not being enough, the self, not the behavior, but the self, that really taps into stress on the survival level. Because if you're not good enough as a being, as a child, you're at risk of somebody abandoning you or neglecting you. Or, you know, I mean, it's actually a fear of death. It can bring up sort of a fear of death. I mean, I'm sure that the children wouldn't articulate it that way or even know how to articulate how they're feeling. But it really activates the limbic part of the brain, which is all about the survival. So when we feel shame as adults, you know, we're not going to respond rationally. It's we're tapping into a lot of subconscious stuff. And the vulnerability is all around the fear and rejection and being revealed as imperfect, and the worthiness and telling yourself, well, I'll be worthy when I do this or when I do that. So putting prerequisites on it. And the living wholeheartedly, the definition is the experience of love and belonging, where we let the whole self be known and seen. And that means our flaws. And everyone has flaws. And, you know, I don't know, our society, even though we might say that, we don't really live that way. We go into judgment and we're very self-critical. So to live this wholehearted way, we need to cultivate trust and show respect and be respected, to show kindness to others and ourselves, and to allow there to be, you know, free affection flowing. And that really leads to the spiritual connection. So living this way opens us to a sense of oneness, opens us to a sense of recognizing that we're connected and that we're connected by something greater than we are. And loving ourselves, that's really the first order of business, because, and Brené certainly isn't the first person to say, you know, that we can only love other people as much as we love ourselves. And so to have a grand experience of love, it really starts with loving yourself and accepting yourself. So I like to think of self-love as putting, so when I'm kind to myself, when I cut myself some slack, and you know, it's a process, but when you recognize that you have those perfectionist tendencies, you can be really hard on yourself. So so when I am kind to myself and cut myself some slack, I think it's a statement to the universe that I'm saying I am worthy. And when we make statements like that, that I am worthy, then the universe responds with, yes, of course you are, you know, and then things open up. And I have wonderful experiences, and I attract people who accept me for who I am. So this whole sense of belonging, I think that is one of those on the Maslow's hierarchy of needs pyramid. That's a very basic, and in the root chakra, the sense of belonging is really, it's in the foundational part of our being. To have a sense of belonging, to have a community, to feel safe, you know, and have our physical needs met, and belonging is similar to the experience of love, as far as we'll have a greater sense of belonging when we have greater self-acceptance. So the universe is mirroring back to us, you know, what's going on inside of us, and so if we're not sure that we're worthy to belong, then our belonging isn't going to be as easy as if we accept ourselves and put ourselves out there. And, you know, especially people like public speakers, people that, you know, do sermons at churches and things, I am always so drawn to the ones that are so vulnerable themselves and talk from their own lives. There's something to me that's irresistible about someone else being vulnerable. Now, I don't know if that's a common experience, but that is my experience. So this sense of belonging, some of you heard me quote Richard Rohr before. He's a Franciscan priest, and he reminds us that you must first remember who you are. You must start with the positive and not with a problem, or you will never get beyond a kind of negative problem solving. Your core, your deepest DNA, is divine. It is the spirit of love implanted within you by your Creator at the first moment of your creation. So if we're spirit and intentionally created by spirit, then our perceived imperfections that are perceived from human standards are not imperfections at all. They are divinely created within us, and I believe it's all for our evolution. And it's not, the imperfections aren't there for us to grow and become perfect, because that, I don't think that's even possible. And it's not there to help us become better so that we avoid criticism or judgment, because that I know is impossible. It's there for our evolution and for us to step out and take the risks to be who we are meant to be. And how many times, you know, do we hear stories of people that have had just horrendous experiences that end up, they, you know, in hindsight, they said that was the best thing that ever happened to me. That's because of that experience, I am who I am today. And I certainly can relate to that from, you know, years of living in depression till my mid-30s and being in, you know, not the healthiest kind of relationships. And all of that caused me to evolve in ways that I'm sure I wouldn't have otherwise. And I am who I am because of that. And I'm so grateful. And I can be grateful even for people that maybe weren't supportive, maybe were even bordered on abusive, that finally gave me strength to stand up and set boundaries and do the things that I needed to do to take care of myself. So when we talk about belonging and societal norms, society most of the culture will tell you, will say, find a way to fit in. And that's such bad advice. I mean, I understand that on one level, you know, when we're kids, to fit in is the easiest route, because if we can fit in, then we've got support, we've got friends, and we're not going to risk the rejection piece. I can get that, but I think at a certain point, fitting in is really it hurts us because we're denying who we are. And maybe you don't have to deny who you are to fit in, if you're in the right, with the right friends and in the right community. And that's what I'm saying. I'm so blessed today because I have that I can be myself, and people love that, my weirdness. You know, it's honored and encouraged, you know, and it's wonderful. So fitting in, if we try to fit in, if we have to squeeze to fit in, you know, to hide to fit in, that is putting our self-worth on the line, actually. And if we aren't accepted, we will feel shame because we denied who we were. Now, if we try to belong and we show our true selves, but we still don't fit in, we might be disappointed, but there will be no shame because we stood in the integrity of who we were. So I thought that was an interesting observation. And Brené says that the goal is to show up and be seen, to just show up and be seen. So we're showing up with who we are and just to be seen. And if we do that, then there will be no shame in who we are. So those that lived wholeheartedly, they had a belief that they were worthy of love and capable of giving love and worthy to belong. And so there again, you know, if you have that belief about yourself, then the universe, the surroundings is going to mirror that back for you. And I have another quote from Richard Rohr that he says, our positive and secure self-image is a divine gift, totally given from the beginning and never self-constructed. It is quite stable and needs no fanfare. So there again, you know, how we come into this world perfect, even with our imperfections, that our true self is divine. And there's no reason to hide that. So again, talking about society's views of vulnerability, it is seen as very negative. And the reason that it's seen as negative is because it's uncomfortable. When we're vulnerable, we're uncomfortable. And yet the most positive experiences come from being vulnerable. The oneness that we feel with each other is felt most deeply when we're in empathy and we can share whatever is going on and say, yeah, me too. That's being vulnerable. Being creative is being vulnerable because you're expressing, making something like a song that didn't exist before. That's, you're putting out your expression that is like nothing else, and that's being vulnerable. And she has a whole piece about creativity and how in about the fourth grade, creativity levels go down, because that's when all of a sudden there's an awareness about, oh, what this classmate has done compared to what I have done. And I think that's the grade where they start actually grading art. And so she said that 85% of the population has creativity scars, and of those, 50% will impact their adult lives and their work life, because they will be less willing to share creatively. You know, that could, I mean, sharing creatively doesn't have to be, you know, in the arts. It can be problem solving, bringing a solution forward at work they're less likely to put themselves out there because they were hurt by being judged or criticized for what they did as children in art. It's also uncomfortable and yet necessary when we love to take the risk of rejection. And just taking risks in general, that with the possibility of failing, all of that is very uncomfortable. But the vulnerability mantra is show up and be seen. Show up and be seen. The authenticity mantra, I love this one, from Brunet is don't shrink, don't puff up, just stay on your sacred ground. So don't hide, don't make yourself bigger than you are, just stay on your sacred ground, just stay with who you are. And I actually have a handout with those two on that, so if you didn't get it written down, you'll get it. So one of the guideposts as far as cultivating authenticity is allowing ourselves to be vulnerable. And the definition for vulnerability is living with uncertainty, taking risks, even though it's uncomfortable. Realizing we aren't meant to be alone, allowing ourselves to be emotionally exposed and living all in. She said that over and over about being all in, you know, willing to take the risk. Loving without certainty of being loved in return. Committing ourselves to what matters to us. And here's another quote from Richard Rohr, who describes the very positive side of being vulnerable. He says, the vulnerable person has every reason to keep growing through everything that happens to them. In contrast, the overly guarded and self-protected person is scratched and dented by all of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, whereas the malleable, bendable, flexible, woundable, vulnerable person is almost indestructible. Their wounds are always allowed to be their teacher instead of their defeat. Their wounds are always allowed to be their teachers instead of their defeat. And so that's the real difference, I think, in those who accept vulnerability as part of life. That they willingly take the risks, that they willingly put themselves out there knowing that, yes, they may fail, and they'll learn from it. And it's not the end of the world. And they have the core strength and the spiritual support that will move them to the next step, whatever that might be. So some of the other practices from the wholehearted, and to me a lot of this is cultivating authenticity and letting go of what people think. And a lot of this sort of overlapped for me. So not caring what other people think, that's in creativity, but it's also in perfectionism. And perfectionism is a lot about worrying about what people think. And so it's having the courage to be imperfect. Perfectionism, I think I mentioned, is it's trying to avoid judgment, criticism, blame, and that is just not possible. And so when I was thinking about, you know, she talked about shame triggers, and it's good to know what your shame triggers are so that you can respond to yourself with kindness and compassion and empathy. And one of mine is, you know, I'm just kind of a messy person. You know, when I go into somebody's house and everything's in its place, you know, and it just looks so beautiful, I think, oh, you know, I wish my house were like that. And I remember when I was a child and I had a messy bedroom, and of course I shared it with my siblings, so we must have all been messy. I don't know. But I remember my mother sending my grandmother back to the bedroom where I was. And I know it was about, you know, she was trying to embarrass me, shame me in front of my grandmother. And what Brené said that's interesting is that when we try to shame people to change the behavior, it actually makes it worse. Whereas if we create guilt around the behavior, that can change the behavior. So, and I'm not real clear about the distinction and how to do that. I think she even has a book on parenting and how to deal with that. But I just thought that was an interesting comparison. And so perfectionism is looking for external validation, whereas healthy striving is internal drive. It's the internal drive. And to me, the internal drive is when we're tapped into spirit and we're listening and following the spiritual guidance. That's healthy. And that's going to lead us to where we're meant to go, I think. The internal guidance, that's where everything is happening and evolving before it manifests in our experience. And I just want to tell you a funny story about perfectionism. So Brené has two children, and I think like 13 and 9, and they go to church every Sunday. And she says, you know, sometimes they're rushed in the morning, and I think they go to a 9:30 service. And so sometimes they're late. And sometimes when they get there, you know, they're not quite dressed the way that she would have liked them to be dressed, you know, because they're rushing. So one Sunday they're there, and there's a new family with four children, you know, and they're like from 12 down, you know, a lot close in age. And they're all dressed to the T, and they're all very well behaved. And so, you know, you would think she would be thinking, boy, that, you know, I would like a family like that, you know, as far as coming from the perfectionist perspective. And I mean, I think she did have that thought, but then she started thinking, how do they get all those kids to behave like that? So, you know, it was like,
fear.
Right, you know, questioning. That's not normal. You know, she's going into judgment. And so even if you're perfect, you're still going to be criticized and judged. Well, then to top that, as she was leaving the church that day, she ran into a friend, and the friend said to Brené, did you see that new family? And Brené said, yeah, they're really something. And the friend said, nah, I thought they were creepy. Yeah. So the perfection that was being revealed was you know, almost seen as abnormal, mm-hmm. to the point of being creepy. So to me, it was just like, wow, the perfectionism is not the goal to strive for. It just truly is not. So the courage to be imperfect, you have to cut yourself some slack and be kind and know that we all struggle. And to know that, to be mindful of what you're feeling without, you know, totally identifying with it and losing perspective. And that can happen to me, where I'm upset about something and I go into the spiral and I lose perspective. You know, I'm like so narrow focused and forget about the big picture and forget about the divine design of my life. And to remember that this may be hard, this may be uncomfortable, but it's part of the process. It's part of life. And I can move through it and find and get back to that place of finding my peace and finding my connection and knowing that all is well and that I have all the support I need. To just remember that divine design. So cultivating authenticity, there's so many ways to do that, and one of them is setting boundaries. And really, she said, it's just being honest when you say no. And it's coming from a place of integrity and to be nice when you say no. And, you know, if someone's asking you to do something and you'd like to, but now isn't the right time, you know, say, well, you know, ask me again. And I don't know if any of you get the daily Om messages from Madison Taylor, but this is what she had to say about saying no. She suggests you remind yourself often that the ability to say no is an important aspect of well-being. It is an indication that you understand the true value of your energy, talent, and time. So really, saying no is a gift to yourself. And actually, she says, in setting boundaries, to choose, you're choosing, how did she say that? It was maybe choosing integrity over resentment. Because if you say no when you really don't want to, in the end, it does cause resentment. You will resent doing what it is you said you would do. Whereas if you're really clear, like, okay, yeah, I want to contribute in this way, or I want to help this person, or whatever it is, then you're all in. There will be no conflict. And so another area where we can feel vulnerable and shame is about being seen as being lazy. That was a very common one. And it often stems from witnessing parents who just always worked. They were always working. Another area is you don't want to be seen as sick, and you may not have seen self-care modeled. You know, with this whole, I had the foot surgery, and it was very synchronistic for me to be listening to this material while I was while my foot was healing, because I did feel a certain level of vulnerability. I wouldn't, you know, that was right when all the snow was falling and streets were slippery, and I was just like, no, I'm not leaving the house, you know, not on crutches. You know, I felt very vulnerable, and I mean, that's wise. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with what I thought. But beneath it, it was such a change, because I've never gone through something like this, to move around on one leg for 5 weeks between a knee caddy and crutches. That's a huge change from someone who's, you know, has a very healthy, capable body to move around. There were many moments where I felt vulnerable, and I was aware of feeling I didn't like having to depend on, you know, my husband getting me things all the time. And, you know, I remember reaching a point where I thought, no, you know, I really don't need that. You know, I'm not going to ask for that. I mean, my fear was of, you know, overburdening him, and that he would burn out and he wouldn't want to take care of me. I mean, I know that would never really happen, but when you're vulnerable, I think you have irrational thoughts because you're in a place of discomfort. And so the Brené talks about two responses with shame. One is that you're not good enough, which we already talked about, which really affects the self. And if you can overcome that, you know, like I could say, if I'm feeling shame about being messy, well, you know, I'm human, and I mean, I can go into all of that and align with my divine self and feel comfortable again. But then she said the second response that comes is, who do you think you are? So you have to be aware of that internal dialogue that goes on, and just really respond with empathy and kindness. Do a reality check. Is it realistic for my home to be always in order? Is that really the way I want to spend my time, you know, making sure that everything's in its place all the time? Hell no. I'd much rather be reading a book or responding to an email or all kinds of other things. So for women, the shame factors come up around appearance of self, appearance of your home. For men, it's about looking weak in whatever way that might be. So the thing is to respond in a way that you find your sacred ground again, that you get grounded in the spiritual nature of your being. You know, that's kind of our saving grace. The other thing that Brené talked about, which I thought was very interesting and meaningful, was empathy. And how truly being with somebody in an empathic way is allowing yourself to be vulnerable, because it requires us to be with them. And the real distinction for me was that she said, sometimes when we're trying to be helpful, it's, and especially with sympathy, she said sympathy is an amplifier for shame. That because it's like, oh, poor dear, you know, I'm saying poor dear to you from up here, you know, you're elevating yourself. Whereas she says true empathy, you are one, you are with that person where they are, and so it's not the healer and the wounded, it's you're both wounded, and you both can be healed. But there's an equalness in sharing that, and I think there's a healing in sharing that with someone, and to be vulnerable in that way and recognize we all have our stuff, we all have our struggles. And this got me thinking, because in science of mind, oftentimes I think there can be, not always, but there can be this spiritual bypass to where, even as a practitioner, we're trained, don't let the client talk about their story. Get them away from the story and get them into what they want. Well, yes, I get that's a much more powerful place to be, and that the story and the pain is at a low vibration, and where they want to be is at a higher vibration. And yes, we want to move to that higher vibration. But I think there is something to be said, and possibly great healing that will take place when we acknowledge the pain and the struggle and recognize that it is part of the human experience. And then, and even at the end, maybe laughing about it and recognizing, because when we're there equal, we can say, it's really hard and we'll get through this, and maybe it's not really that bad. Not to dismiss somebody's experience, but to elevate them to, you're in the experience, but looking again at that broader perspective, looking for the bigger picture. So that was meaningful to me, to recognize that oneness as a spiritual component of empathy, and to say I'm here with you. To say I'm here for you, is different. It's. To be with somebody in the muck of life is meaningful, I think. And from there, I think with the healing and the shared experience, then I think you really can move to a high vibration, a place of recognizing what's possible, and perhaps even soaring together. So that was meaningful to me. Some other practices that she encouraged was cultivating intuition and faith. And that means letting go of certainty. And so intuition is, the definition is that there's no one way of knowing, that we can know from many, many ways, through our hearts, through our heads, through reason. But when we're in a place of stress, and especially when we're looking for an answer, that stress can shut off all the guidance that is continually flowing to us. And so she said that if you can hold a space for uncertainty and relax, that you will get clarity and good outcomes. And that and to just remember that the universe is working things out for our best. The definition of faith is a place of mystery, where we find the courage to believe in what we cannot see and the strength to let go of the need for certainty. And so she said that this can be a bounce back place, that our spiritual practices can help us bounce back from the vulnerability, from feeling shame, from all of that. And she said that when we're feeling stressed, and especially when we're looking for an answer to something, that it can take us out of balance, and that the discomfort of not knowing, the discomfort of uncertainty, can make us say things like, well, screw it, I'll just do it, you know, because we're tired of being in the unknown. And her mantra, if you don't know, is to, if in doubt, don't do it. If in doubt, don't do it. So you want to give yourself time to come to a place of comfort and knowing around what you're trying to figure out. And it reminded me of another little trick that I learned from Alan Cohen. And he said that if you're indecision about something, you know, and you're going back and forth and back and forth and you can't decide, he said, take a coin and assign one way, you know, one decision to heads and one decision to tails. And he said, when you flip that coin, whatever comes up, you're going to have a gut reaction. It's either going to be, all right, or it's going to be, oh. And he said, there's your decision, you know, there it is. It's right there. And so sometimes I forget about that little trick and go through a lot of agonizing and soul-searching and looking for guidance and going into nature. And there it was, right in that coin. Okay, so I want to just give her definition of spirituality. Holding a belief that we are definitely connected to each other by something greater, which gives us a sense of purpose and perspective. We let go of powerlessness and by having a greater perspective. So that's what spirituality allows me often, is to have a greater perspective, is to quiet the human, you know, some people call it ego, I call it the little child in me that might be fearful, to calm that child and allow spirit to tell me the truth of what's really going on and find comfort there and know that, you know, I'm always being guided. So as I said, there was a whole lot of information. Cultivating play was very interesting. She talked about the research on violent offenders and that they found that a lot of violent offenders were not allowed to play very much as children. And the opposite of no play is not work. It's depression. Yeah. So if you're not allowing yourself enough playtime, you may be feeling down, you may be feeling depressed. And this is the question that we're going to come back to that I'd like you to think about in regards to play. What do you love to do so much that you lose track of time and suddenly it's hours later? And I have this question on your handout. Where do you... where you're not self-conscious and can be goofy and weird and let yourself do whatever you want, where you don't want it to end and it doesn't have a purpose. So maybe we'll end kind of on that question. One of the things, Brené asked her family this question. And the response from her family has totally changed the way they take vacations. Because what they all loved doing was things like hiking and swimming and fishing and playing some yard game, Foursquare, I think it's called. And so Disney World was not in there. They now go a few miles down the road to a house on a lake and rent the house. And so within that surroundings fulfills all of the things that overlapped as far as in their responses of what they all love to do. I thought that was really interesting and how wise of her to honor that. And so let me just end with a quote from Theodore Roosevelt. Hopefully I can get through it without crying, because it makes me cry. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doers of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the person who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred with dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again, who at best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly.
Thank you. Yeah.